8 p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
And live from our studios here in Accra and linking up with all our regional FM stations and on the internet, we say welcome to Behind the News, our news and current affairs program examining issues from the perspective of newsmakers and experts. I am Kingsley Obinchere. And for tonight, true to his word, former Libyan leader, Brother Muammar al-Gaddafi, fought to his death. What becomes of post-Gaddafi Libya? How have various agricultural initiatives encouraged the youth into that sector of the economy? And what do you know about tax havens and how do they affect the country's development? More on these issues. It's Behind the News, live from our national studios here in Accra. And as usual, we encourage you to send in your text to 026-441-8767. And to our first story. The Libyan situation took a different turn this afternoon when reports filtered in that the ousted leader Muammar al-Gaddafi has been killed. The atmosphere painted by reports on BBC and Al Jazeera showed scenes of jubilation. Some have, however, expressed concern about the turn of events and are questioning the motives of NATO in continuing with bombardments. For this section of people, the leadership of the National Transitional Council have just handed itself over to NATO. To NATO's manipulation, how will the turn of events in the once thriving country influence the future? What about the role of the United Nations in the crisis? Well, we have now on the line to examine these issues Dr. Yael Graham of the Third World Network. Dr. Yael, welcome to Behind the News.
Thank you.
First of all, I want to take your view about the killing of Gaddafi.
I mean, the killing of Gaddafi, in a sense, given the way the war had developed and the strategic shift in favor of the opposition, it was only a matter of time when the supporters of the Gaddafi government were going to be defeated, and therefore he will be caught up in something, either captured, escape the country, or be killed fighting. So in that sense, what has happened to him, if you take away the barbarism of, you know, the way the dead body was treated, and clearly was shot in the head, you know, after being captured and so on, there's an underlying text, you know, of viciousness. You look at the way African migrants in Libya have been treated in this war. There's been a mood of great viciousness in the way the war has been fought. So in that sense, it is not very surprising what has happened. And he was clearly not going to leave Libya, so he fought till the end.
Yeah. Do you think he should have fled before now?
Well, that one is a judgment which is difficult, you know, to make. People make these choices on the basis of their belief, you know, in terms of the way, you know, they want to die. And some people will choose, you know, death over the indignity of being paraded around. He was captured. He didn't kill himself. I mean, he clearly was captured and somebody shot him in the head. So in that sense, having been captured, somebody killed him, you know, in cold blood. So he didn't kill himself. He was killed in cold blood after being captured.
Yeah, you've expressed concern about the barbarism, but some are also expressing concern about even right from the beginning, the UN resolution that led to NATO's intervention, and are asking, was it even well intended, looking at the way Libya has gone through crisis?
I think we should separate a number of things. A number of countries who voted for that resolution to impose a no-fly zone have consistently opposed the abuse and extension, the illegal extension of the terms of that resolution by NATO. So South Africa, for example, which voted for that resolution, was very much in the forefront of attempts by the African Union to try and bring about a political solution which would have saved lives and the destruction which has gone on in Libya. But NATO definitely was on its own agenda, which also explains why throughout they completely sidelined the African Union and preferred to use the Arab League, which was dominated by NATO allies and people who were hostile to Gaddafi, as a vehicle for their international diplomacy. When President Zuma was leading an African Union delegation to Tripoli, NATO informed him that they could not guarantee his safety. That was the extent of their determination to prevent any solution except the one that they wanted. So the NATO thing clearly represents another instance of the abuse of multilateral fora, you know, by a clique of countries, which it's important to draw attention to.
You've spoken about abuse. Quickly, as you refer to the South African intervention, as it was intended, many people ask, what was the African Union even doing then?
Well, to be fair, that Africa, if you, the African Union Security, Peace and Security Committee met many, many times and took many, many positions, but there are a number of problems here. One, the people who took charge of the NATO agenda, of the Libya agenda, on the platform of the UN, the US and its allies in NATO, were never going to allow an African Union role in the thing, because the position the African Union was expressing was not favorable to what they wanted to achieve in Libya. Two, the African Union is very poor in communicating its position to even its own constituents. You have to go to the African Union website to find out what the committees were doing. Okay? So, unfortunately, one push came to shove. The African Union's weaknesses were gravely exposed. But the substance of the positions that they took recognized that the Libya needed political transition, that the authoritarian rule of Gaddafi had to end, but wanted a negotiated solution. The African Union did not support the continuation of the kind of regime that Gaddafi was running in Libya. But they were hoping for a political transition similar, incidentally, to what the Americans are supporting in Yemen. Okay, in Yemen, they are supporting a political transition there. Okay, it's a near civil war situation. So the contrast has to do really with a geostrategic determination of NATO to bring about change, which they hope will be favorable to them. So whether the outcome, when things settle down, will be a pro-Western regime, I think it's still too early to call.
Yeah. So are you seeing some double standards there? Because you are referring to Yemen and people point to Syria quickly.
Double standards have been a permanent part of Western diplomacy. Double standards have been a permanent part of Western diplomacy. I mean, today I was reading Cameron saying how today was a great day, you know, for those who want freedom and so on. This same Cameron, a few days ago, was saying people should celebrate the achievements of the British Empire. If you lived under British colonialism, there's very little to celebrate. But he thinks there's something to celebrate. Even that shows, you know, his mindset. So double standards really has been part of that. After America lied to start a war in Iraq, NATO did not even get an international mandate to attack Yugoslavia in 1999. So double standards are very much been part of the fabric of Western diplomacy.
So on the bigger front, people point to gumboot diplomacy, and there are times that we say it is long past, but it appears it's been introduced in some cases. Can the UN, looking at the way it gave a mandate and yet was not able to control whatever was done with it, have a say?
Well, these are some of the issues which have led developing countries to call for a reform of the Security Council, to move away from the outmoded situation where Britain, which basically hangs on the coattails of the United States, which is a middle power, continues to claim a seat on the council because of what happened, you know, in the Second World War 60 years ago. France has a seat. So that the Security Council has to be reformed so it reflects the actual balance of power and also population, you know, in the world. And I think this is a very important lesson also to draw, that the key institution of multilateral diplomacy, like the Security Council, really are outmoded in the way power is set up there.
So with the demise of Gaddafi, do you see peace returning to Libya soon, especially looking at the circumstances surrounding it?
Well, he certainly was very, very much in the center of the rally. And with his death, you know, I mean, normally what happens in these cases is that supporters would see that, you know, the game is up. And with the fall of Sirte also, I think the NTC would be able to establish its authority. Their main challenge now will be to see how the different groups who, for different reasons, dislike Gaddafi, but were united against him, will now have to find out how they find a common front so that the country can be stabilized and reconstruction, you know, can take place. And in that sense, speaking, you know, as an African, I mean, it's my own desire that another African country very quickly comes out of this war, stabilizes and offers its people, you know, a future which, you know, it's worth the sacrifice, you know, that people have made. Thousands have died, you know, Libyans and non-Libyans, and it's in everybody's interest that the situation stabilizes and Libyans are able to build their country that they're happy with, so that the trauma of this civil war becomes a thing in the past, and that people feel that the price paid for it was worthwhile.
So in Syrians for Peace, do you see the NTC extending the olive branch to those who were fighting on the side of Gaddafi?
Well, I mean, you can't run a country by continuing a policy of hostility. If after a civil war, reconstruction is only possible if you actually also seek reconciliation, so that everybody feels that it's a common country and that the divisions of the past are behind, and that everybody unites, you know, to move the country forward.
Yeah, you are talking about a country that was thriving, even though people might have concerns about the long stay of Gaddafi. Now that is gone, people are looking at the interest of NATO and other powers that went in. Do you see other things happening?
Well, that certainly is an important issue, because if you look at the heavy role that NATO played, the heavy role that the autocratic regimes in the Gulf. I mean, it's an ultimate irony that countries like Saudi Arabia, you know, where women can't even drive, you know, there's nothing like participation of ordinary people. One of the most authoritarian regimes who are kept out of the headlines because it's in the interest of the West. They played a key role, you know, in the overthrow of Gaddafi. It's important to remember that one of the things that Gaddafi did after coming to power was to close down one of the major air bases that NATO had on its south flank, which was based, you know, in Libya. And I don't think he was ever forgiven for that. He nationalized the oil. They didn't forgive him for that. At least the legacy of those nationalist acts, hopefully, the NTC and its successors will build on it so that Libya retains its ability to operate for self-determination. If Libya goes back to being a surrogate of NATO, that would be a tragic loss for all the people who lost their lives in the claim of wanting to build a true democracy. Because a true democracy must be one where people are able to exercise self-determination without external, you know, interference or cajoling.
But do you see them really asserting that independence, looking at the way they've been supported?
There is going to be a sorting out before the future of Libya politically settles. Because there are people there who yesterday were being handed over by Gaddafi to the West as Islamists, who are now being supported by the West to overthrow Gaddafi. Question is, what is their memory about how they were treated yesterday as an enemy? So there are different political tendencies who have united against Gaddafi. There is no tradition of an open political culture where we resolve these contradictions, you know, through negotiations and so on. In the heat of war, it's easy to forge a unity against a common enemy. You know, in the ease of peace, every group is likely to be seeking to consolidate its own interests. So we have to wait and see how the post, you know, Gaddafi period, you know, plays out. I think there'll be a period where, you know, there'll be a lot of sorting out, regrouping, repositioning, realignment before we see a kind of clear line in terms of policy and stability.
Okay. Dr. Yao Graham, I want to thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us this evening. He's with the Third World Network. But we have joining us now lawyer Osei Kwejue, media law lecturer at the Ghana Institute of Journalism. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, my brother.
Yes, we want to tackle it from the media perspective. Listening to events as they unfolded, even before now, some have said that it appeared Gaddafi is totally black and there is nothing good about him. How do you see the reportage?
This is a kind of a problem, and I just see a very big contradiction in this whole affair which has led to the death of Saddam Hussein. One part of the contradiction is the fact that he has lived his whole life as a head of state, which in modern governance is not the norm, in the sense that one person cannot be the head of state for that long, about 40 plus years. And the fact that the world is moving towards a situation where leaders come, they are assessed, they are vetted, and then if they are found to be okay, they are made to stay. If not, they are made to go, and then others come. This is one leg of the contradiction. And the other part of it is the fact that African leaders have, or the AU, has virtually been helpless in resolving this situation in such a way that lives would not have been lost, and Gaddafi would perhaps have been spoken to, and he would have agreed to the fact that the way to rule now is not to leave, to overstay your office. And so my worry basically is the fact that African media could not come on the side of Gaddafi, whether or not he was wrong, and then perhaps to get to set an agenda on his long stay, and then to get him to leave the seat of governor and get somebody else to also take his place. So you realize that the media could not say much about Gaddafi, but rather the media allowed a lot to be done by the Western media. The media in Africa did not do much, but the Western media just painted Gaddafi black, and then at the end of the day, this is the result that we have seen. Which means that, yes, Africans do not have control over their own affairs.
Yeah, you are saying so, but some are saying that when a pan-African media was tried, it collapsed. That means that they were relying, and we'd say it's a global village now. Does that mean that it is time they set up that media again?
Yes, it is true, because, yes, there is an agenda that the African media must also push, and who will do that? And leaders who will do that are the likes of Gaddafi and perhaps Kwame Nkrumah and the rest. But as it is now, those leaders, when they push the African agenda, it looks as if the global agenda, which is being pushed by the West, tends to dominate. And therefore, the African media itself tends to skew itself more towards the agenda that the Western media is setting. And by the time you are aware, African leaders who try to stand up against the West are seen to be bad leaders, and therefore must be dealt with. And therefore, when the West sets in to deal with them, it looks as if the whole of Africa is helpless.
Do you see any bright future for Libya from now?
For now, I'll take the wait and see attitude, because after this kind of devastation, certainly I'm sure Gaddafi also has some followers, and I'm sure they will also want to come to the table with their own view of how things should go. And of course, those who have overthrown Gaddafi would also have their position. And these two positions must be reconciled. And how it will play out would depend upon the chemistry in Libya at the moment. So for now, I'll take a wait and see attitude. I don't know whether the Western powers would want to go there and do the reconstruction. And when that becomes the norm, that perhaps the followers of Gaddafi would have to be dealt with. And if that is going to be the case, then there's no going to be peace. But as it is, I would rather prefer to take the wait and see attitude, and then to see how Libyans would handle their own affairs.
Lawyer Sekoji, I want to thank you very much for your time.
He's
a media lecturer at the Ghana Institute of Journalism. Dr. Vladimir Mchidanso is a senior fellow at the Lagos Center for International Affairs and Development. He's also joined us on the line. Doc, are you also going to have a wait and see attitude looking at the future of Libya?
I do not think there is any wait and see attitude over here. History has told us, or has shown us, that once such situations happen, the whole generation is lost. We're going to see a gradual reconstruction of Libya, and it depends on the direction. If the leaders now want to go Western, we're going to see a Western kind of development, which will take so many years to crystallize. If they develop any other direction, so Arabic, or if it's going to be a kind of bureaucratic state, it's also going to take a long time. All of them have their, each of them has their own kind of demand. You know, so I don't believe in any with the key attitude. The whole thing is that Libya is going to go through this turmoil for
number of years before it can settle. And depending on the leadership, and depending on the type of institutions they put in place for the reconstruction of Libya, the Libyans will now see countries that want to kill.
Okay, it appears we are having a little challenge with your line. If you can please reposition yourself a little. But we are talking about governance here, and two previous speakers have mentioned that issue of governance. But part of the Arab world supporting the process are not democratic. So what are they saying?
That is the biggest conflict we are grappling with throughout the world. That's the biggest conflict. What kind of democracy does your question mean? Purpose to see. That's what I'm saying. Anything that does not include the people, that does not build specific institutions that could create their own dynamo, it would be very difficult to call it anything. If you want to superimpose Western democracy kind of governance onto Libya, onto any of the Arab world, it will not work. And all you have to get is a kind of dictator or a group of people who are supported by the West, and you give a semblance of democracy or a semblance of something. Saudi Arabia is not democratic. None of them. But they are getting the Western lagging. Is that what Libya is going to be? So I say the leadership must create a certain platform where all Libyans believe that this is the direction we are going. And it depends on the kind of institutions they will put in place. Will the Electoral Commission be independent? Will the military, the police, all other state institutions, will they be independent of governance? That is the democracy. And that type of democracy, if you call it Western, fine, call it that way. But any democracy, Western, Eastern, Central, if it doesn't have institutional props and everything is, led to the leader, like Gaddafi's kind of thing, like the Saudi system, like any other system that is based on one man or an oligarchy, cannot be called a democracy. If Gaddafi had built the system, would have defended him, not he himself defending himself. Look at Cuba, has built a system, and the system is defending the Cuban state, and the Cuban state is revolutionizing itself every day. So is China. China didn't destroy itself. You know, the system was not built. The former Soviet Union didn't build a system. Leadership was telling the people what to do. But China has its own system, and they are changing according to the times to suit Chinese people. So the future of Libya does not rely on Western democracy. Kind of whatever. It depends on Libyan kind of democracy.
Yeah. So with the sidelining of the African Union in the processes, do you see them also trying to go in now?
The African Union has lost legitimacy. We are divided. Did you know the number of countries that supported the Transitional Council? They are about half Africa, and the two didn't support are about half. So first and foremost, the front line for African Union is broken. They don't have the wherewithal. They don't have the logistics. They don't have even leadership. There is no leadership in the EU. The EU is being prepared by France and Germany. They are, yes. When they say we're going, they're going. If they are lackadaisical, the European Union falls. We don't have that in Africa. So today, the legitimacy, the cogency of the African Union cannot be relied upon.
So what do we say? Are there implications for the rest of the countries on the continent? You know, many people were migrating to that country.
Very serious implications. Very, very serious implications. If Gaddafi is hurt, if Libya is suffering, then the whole of Africa is suffering. Because Libya was supporting a number of African countries, about 23 of them. Pay their dues and levies of the EU. He was bankrolling the EU. He was a lot of the things, the satellites that we wanted to put in space, Africa could not do it. Libya gave the seed money and things like that. We are going to lose all that, you know. I don't say that's the reason for which Gaddafi should have stayed. What I'm saying is that whatever situation has befallen Gaddafi will have some implications on Africa generally. Secondly, the outfall. Guns are everywhere. Al-Qaeda in North Africa has regrouped, and they are gleefully embracing the elements of pro-Gaddafi forces who have left the place or in Algeria now, and most of them are in Mali. And they have announced, yesterday they announced, that they are now going to be more active. So all these things have implications for Africa.
Does that mean we have a potential Iraq on hand?
Sure, sure. That is what I see. That's why I don't have to think of any wait and see. A potential of Iraq is clearly there in Libya. If you know the Libyan history, then you know it's going to happen.
Dr. Vladimir Entretas, we want to thank you very much for your time too.
You're very welcome.
as a senior fellow at the Lagos Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy on the line. Behind the news, linking up with all our regional FM stations. Olubunu, you are on 96.5, that is at Tema, Unique 95.7, and also Sunrise in Koforidua. Some of your tests. This one from AU Farouk Tamale Kingsley. Indeed, the Arab world is now getting to total collapse. May the soul of Gaddafi rest in perfect peace. And alas, in Zabzugu, may Gaddafi's soul rest in peace. But Africans should know that we lost a great leader, a leader who will never get in Africa till thy kingdom come. But God will punish those who have a hand in his killing. And Nelson from Bole, Gaddafi, why didn't you die early to save the lives lost? And from Stephen Osei of Esasi Bontufu, oh Gaddafi, may your soul rest in perfect peace. And this one is asking, if Gaddafi is dead for a fact, then presidents worldwide must be ready to relinquish power when the need arises. That is Bright Nungwa. And this one, the killing of Colonel Gaddafi is a lesson to other African leaders. Daniel Opoku from Teleku Bokazo. You are live on Twin City Radio and Radio Central together with Radio Savannah. Any attempt to count the number of times it has been to announce that agriculture is the backbone of Ghana's economy will leave one gasping for breath. Successive governments have been exploring ways to encourage the country's people to go into agriculture, but their response has not been at the desired level. Why is this so? For the past 5 days, the National Farmers and Fishermen Award Winners Association of Ghana has been collaborating with others to organize an agricultural trade fair at the International Trade Fair Center, LA, to encourage more people to know about the benefits of agriculture. What is the source of motivation for the association? We have been joined on the line by the 1986 National Best Farmer, George Alokodongo, who is also the chairman of the Council of Elders of the National Farmers and Fishermen Award Winners Association. Good evening, sir, and you are welcome to the program. Hello, Mr. Alokodongo.
Yes, good evening, sir.
Yes. We've been talking about agriculture for some time and saying it is the backbone of the economy. From the steps taken so far to make it look so, do you think we are making any headway?
Actually, Ghana is one of African countries that is actually has its population of about 70%. That depends on agric. Actually, the Minister of Food and Agric is making heavy, but yes, as much as we the farmers too must also try our best to also put see whether we can let our produce or project our produce so that our colleague farmers from our neighboring countries can also know that in Ghana we the Ghanaian farmers can produce this. And we can also have this to be exported and so on and so forth. But if we just solely rely on government, I don't think that is the best. That is why we, the award winners in FAWA, Ghana National Association of Farmers and Fishermen Award Winners, have decided on our own to showcase our products to the rest of our brothers in Ghana, as well as the whole Africa and that of the world, that we, the Ghanaian award winners, have got products made in Ghana that is very nice, and that when you buy, they're equally like those made from abroad.
Yeah. So you are talking about other things we can get from it. But so far, as you mentioned, not many people, in spite of the fact that you are talking about 70%, many of the youth are migrating to the urban areas. Does that mean that they don't see anything good coming out of agriculture?
In natural fact, agriculture is a very difficult type of business because for the past, people haven't taken agriculture as a business. They took it like something like, if I'm a school dropout, the next thing is to go and farm. And they are used to the hoe and cutlass. Now, what is happening now is that we the farmers have seen it that we have to move ahead. We have to move ahead. By moving ahead in this case, we are trying to say that's why we showcase ourselves. If you come to the show that we have organized by ourselves, we haven't done it through the help of any government. We did everything on our own with the Award Winners Association. We have done it. To let people know that we are moving ahead, what I mean to tell is that we have been able to get the government to bring something like insurance for farmers. To produce your goods if there is floods or there are no rains, and you insure your farm, you'll be able to what, to get back the money and go back into the business. With this, you see that the youth will be encouraged to stay back. This is one of the reasons why the youth are drifting away. And even to assess funding is a problem. But if you have, you go to the bank, and the insurance companies are prepared to ensure your loan you are going to take this from the bank, they won't hesitate giving it to you. And therefore, you can do your production without fear. And you know, with this, once you have insured, the one who is also coming to buy is also insured. And you don't have problem about producing, neither do you have problem about marketing.
Yeah.
Most of the youth is running away because of marketing.
From what you are saying, you've been able to do this on your own. Does that mean that you can leave government out altogether in tackling the problems confronting the sector?
No, we are not leaving government out altogether. But it's like a family. A family of so many children, you see. Let's take Ghana as a family. And then you have got so many children. If you want to just wait on your father and mother, that they must always bring you food to eat, I don't think it's the best. You must be taught how to fish. Then you can eat the fish. So we are saying that if we have to wait, we are not the doctors are there, they are on site. So many other workers are there, the government has to take to cater for them. So we are saying that why don't we strive forward as the nation's farmers that we have been recognized by Ghana that we are the best farmers. So we must strive hard to make sure that our business succeeds.
Yes.
And doing this, we want the whole Ghanaian public to know that we are no more farmers, but we are agro-businessmen.
Yeah. Well, when you mentioned that, yes.
Make sure our business succeeds.
Yeah. Mr. Lokodongo, you've mentioned one of the factors that may be working against young people getting into agriculture, and marketing is one. Processing is also very important. We've heard so much about factories being revived so that it can help farmers. Your produce should not go to waste. An example is Palugu. Do you find them really working so that as you do your own thing with the recognition, you get the support that is needed from elsewhere?
Yes, currently the Ministry of Trade, through our initiative, the Ministry of Trade and Industry, together with other insurance companies, have given money, food money to the factory to buy from farmers. And they are prepared to grant loans to farmers, provided we, the farmers, in the Upper East are prepared to sell our produce to the factory. You know, it's just like a value chain. You know where to sell your produce when you produce. Like, instead of us waiting for the market women to come, the Palugu tomato factory, the government has supported with some money and some bankers who have, in addition, supported. These very banks that have supported the factory have also, are also going to support farmers because there is security for their loans being granted to the farmers. You know, the insurance company will come, guarantee the loan for the farmers, as we have done now. We've had an agreement with Star Insurance, Capital Investment, and many others who were there at the stand, as you saw. All these people are prepared to work with the association so that farmers or the award winners, we are not saying award winners alone, farmers in Upper East in general and Northern region where the tomato is being produced. You assess the funding from the bank, you assess your insurance guarantee. You see, then the bank is giving you, you know that the Palugu tomato factory, they have also gotten money from the same bank, you see, to buy your produce. So when the bank is giving you money, they don't fear because they know that Palugu is there, you will buy, and then they will collect the money and go and pay. The only thing that we are now trying to let farmers to know is that we have to trust the ability to trust. What I mean by trust is that you are taking a loan for tomato, they are going to farm to feed the Palugu tomato factory. Therefore, when you go and they pay you, make sure that you pay back your loan.
Yeah.
The insurance cover is okay for you.
So
you can continue the following year.
Yeah. Mr. Lokodongo, is the fair being well patronized?
Yes. Yes, the factory this year will be very patronized because we are putting in, we are now trying to put in certain measures. Like the factory is without, how can you have a company or a big company like without a board?
Okay.
We, the Award Winners Association, is trying to team up with the Regional Coordinating Council of Upper East, as well as MOTI, that is the Ministry of Trade and Industry, to set up something like a board that can run the factory successfully for it to be profitable.
Okay, but I'm asking, is the present fair being organized, being well patronized?
Yes.
The trade fair you are organizing about Agric.
Yes.
Are many people showing interest in it?
Yes, you know, definitely. People are showing interest. If you come, we have got our colleague farmers from Nigeria. They are in to showcase their products. Colleague farmers from Ouagadougou, they are so in to showcase their products. We have India Group. You would imagine that a company all the way from Switzerland has expressed interest with the NFAWAC, the Award Winners Association, and they are prepared to produce fertilizer in Ghana here for us and bag it in the name of NFAWAC at a cost lesser than even the government reduced price of fertilizer for us.
Okay.
We have gone around with them. They are prepared to establish a factory in Tamale and one in Accra here. So within the next 1 year, in fact, we said there will be a lot of changes in the farming for we the Ghanaians to enjoy. So, for example, if you came, the Liberians were here to showcase their products. See, so we learn from each other, and we the farmers ourselves.
Okay.
But, you know, Inita, let me tell you, my brother, by all means, when you are starting something, there will be difficulties. So we have had several difficulties. For example, let me tell you, the farmers, we've invited 10 farmers from each region. It's just at the beginning. So we face some difficulties, like accommodation and many other things, the logistics. And, you know, another thing is, those who are our sponsors. When you are starting something, definitely you cannot get sponsors. And if you don't get enough sponsors, that means you will not have enough money to run. But by the grace of God, we are managing and we learn from our mistakes.
Okay. And, Mr. Alokodongo.
Come next year. We'll do it much more better.
Okay. We want to thank you very much for your time this evening, Mr. George Alokodongo.
Thank you very much.
That is the 1986 National Best Farmer and also Chairman of the Council of Elders of the National Farmers and Fishermen Award Winners Association. But a number of seminars have been organized as part of the Agric Trade Fair, and they are focusing on agri financing and insurance, value chain and export, post-harvest management and safety of fish and their products. The farmers have been actively assisted by academia and those working in the industry. Dr. Peter Zida is a veterinary doctor, and he is specializing in fish diseases and working with the Fisheries Commission. He is sharing some thoughts with us on fish diseases, something that we do not talk about so much. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Why should we be so much concerned about fish diseases?
We should be concerned about fish diseases because... in the first place, we are going to aquaculture, and for every culture system or animal husbandry system, you are moving the animals from their natural environment to an artificially created environment. So as soon as you move people or you move things to such environments, diseases become a problem. That is why we should be concerned. Apart from that, what we eat from this product also becomes a concern, a public health concern to us, because if some of the diseases in the aquatic environment, we already have some of these diseases. If the fishes or the animals are not well looked after, and you eat, some of these diseases can be transferred to humans. That's what we call the zoonosis.
Yeah. Is it so prevalent, especially with the aquaculture?
Yeah, aquaculture, diseases are a problem in aquaculture. In countries where aquaculture started without disease management being put into it, most of the industries collapsed, especially the Asian tigers who are now coming up. That is why we're trying to put aquaculture as a health, as a basis for, aquaculture. If you already watch the poultry industry, you see diseases are a problem. The same way to aquaculture. We are lucky that it's an emerging industry in Ghana. And so for the time being, the issues confronting us are all very heavy. The casualties are not as heavy as it does in the old economies. So we should have concerns about them.
When we say a fish is having a disease, how will anyone tell immediately?
Yes, there are clinical signs that come with all these diseases, just like any animal disease or human disease. So there are signs that you see, one of the signs are that you feed your fish, and when you go and give your fish food and he doesn't eat, what do you think? Or is it your baby? Then two, you see the fish is a special way of swimming. If you see the fishes are not swimming that particular way, you should know there's a problem. Three, you see at certain times the fishes come to gather at the place, opening their mouths, looking for air. All these things tell you that there's a problem in the environment for them. You see? Yeah.
Yeah. So, talking to the farmers, do you have many people showing interest in the area now and being concerned about this particular problem?
Yes, yes. Those who are in aquaculture already, we've done some awareness, and those who are in it have seen it. Initially, people thought fishes were not sick. But now those who are, how do you call it, in it, have realized that there are a lot of problems. So we try to teach them, give them ideas about how to prevent these things. And a case in point is one catfish hatchery owner in Kumasi. He never believed there were diseases. But after some time, any time he hatches his catfish, so many thousands or millions, in 2 weeks' time, they all die. Until we told him that some of the problems came from him, and we changed his management style and everything. And today, he is harvesting all the fishes that he used to look.
Yeah. So, can you trace the disease to a particular location?
Depending. You see, like animals, they are also prone to other diseases. They are also prone to the bacteria, viral, parasites, fungals. And apart from that, they are prone to the non-infectious diseases, like the cancers, the nutritional, and environmental problems. So, traceability, fine, yes. You can trace diseases. And all this depends. That is why in the new fisheries regulation that has come out, we are certifying hatcheries. We are giving permits to people to move animals. One of the important things is to give permits, so that when there's a problem, you can trace to a particular farm that where the problem is. Like now we have realized that some of the parasites being transferred from one hatchery to another. I wouldn't mention the name of the hatchery anyway, but the person knows. We've now told people not to go and buy their fingerless, because we realize that there's a parasitic problem there, which when they move the fish to their area, to their cages or to their ponds, these fishes, how do you call it, don't grow well. Some of them die. So it becomes an economic hardship to the, how do you call it, farmers.
Dr. Peter Zida, we want to thank you very much too for joining us this evening.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, too. Thank
That's
you.
A veterinary doctor and working with the Fisheries Commission, telling us about fish disease issue. Ghana is seen as an attractive investment destination for the country. This should subsequent taxes that should be channeled taxes are channeled out of the country as multilaterals explore a tax haven system. How is this system operating to the detriment of this country? Recently, ISODEC raised the red flag about the tax havens and called for urgent steps to address the situation. Behind the News explores the issue, and joining us on the line is Bernard Anaba of ISODEC. Bernard, you are welcome to Behind the News.
Thank you, Kingsley.
Tax havens, what are they?
Tax havens, previously as known, thought to be small island states that do not have particular natural resources or have a significant play in the world market system. So they tend to kind of sell their sovereignty to attract capital from other parts of the world. And they offer secrecy and offer sometimes very low tax system or no tax at all, and sometimes no regulation at all. An example is Switzerland, as we all know. And we have other examples such as Luxembourg, we have the Cayman Islands, Isle of Wight, a whole lot of them. And they have actually increased significantly since the 1980s. In the 1980s, research shows that they were about just 30, and now they are about 60 and over. And this provides the opportunity for multinationals to actually channel their resources from wherever they operate to these tax havens in order to avoid taxes where they actually operate.
But Bernard, the concern is that once they've managed to establish an industry here or any company here, people are being employed. So that one should not be so much of concern. Why should we be concerned?
Yes, we should be concerned because we know taxes actually can be equated to estate. or the state of development in every country. Taxes are used for development, and taxes are used to kind of redistribute income and also kind of bring about some equity around the world or in countries. So if taxes are being avoided or a channel to elsewhere, then we should be concerned. And recently, you know about the fact that somebody in the U.S., a rich person in the U.S., called Warren Buffett, said that he wasn't being taxed enough. And that led to people rising up to the issue. And the issue came to the fore that about only 1% of the world population controls about 90% of the world resources or wealth. And that should be a concern. And it's all because of the unfair tax system around the world. And because of this, we should all be concerned. And developing countries in particular, like Ghana, we suffer most because we don't have the administrative system or the system to be able to track these taxes. So we suffer most from tax avoidance and tax evasion.
Does that mean that anything being channeled out of here, we cannot even trace?
Yes, it's actually difficult to trace, and that is the main issue. The issue is that whatever is channeled to secret jurisdictions, these secret places, it's difficult to find out what is there. For instance, if you hear that somebody has embezzled money from Ghana and people say in Switzerland, how are you going to find out? You will never get to know. That is why the global campaign is calling for all countries to be transparent about the accountancy system in terms of having a country-by-country reporting system where any company that operates in two or more countries should report the should give a financial report in that particular country, not just the consolidated accounts, where you will not be able to know how much tax it has paid in one country or another, or how much profit it has made in one country or another. A country might be operating 100% in Ghana, but might be making more profit in tax haven, where it doesn't actually do anything by only having representatives there.
So do we have particular companies we've identified here, since ISODEC is raising the concerns in this country, that seem to be operating with these tax havens?
There are a whole lot of them. There are most of the multinationals actually channel their investment through tax havens. I can tell you that recent research shows that 98% of all the top 100 companies registered in the FTSE 100, the UK stock exchange, all operate through tax havens. So that tells you the problem, how big the problem actually is. And I can give an example of Submiller. Submiller is the second largest beer producing company in the world, and its subsidiary in Ghana is Accra Brewery. Over the last 2 years, it said that Submiller hasn't paid any corporate tax. However, Submiller, through research, shows that it has been able to send up to about $30 million to Switzerland and Netherlands through trademark and management fees and all that it gets through operating in Ghana through the beer industry. Not just in Ghana, but in Africa in the beer industry. So that tells you that there are a lot of companies, there are examples, but I mean, it would be unfair to mention a name. But Submiller in particular, this has been a research incident or something that has been researched on, and it is out there and everybody knows about what they have done.
So you are talking about an international problem. In this case, are various countries getting together since individually they will also be losing?
Yes, at a global level, there is a huge campaign out there to get the G20 in particular and G8 to actually agree to bring out some regulations that will bring some sanity and transparency in the financial system around the world. At a local level, we may not have so much to do about that because we are not represented on the G20. But what we can do is to have policies that will be able to track some of these things. The problem actually is administrative in the sense that you need a well-resourced tax auditors to be able to follow these trails and to be able to question every deal that is made in country. But if you don't have that capacity, it's going to be difficult. So we by and large, rely on the international financial world system, or on the international the G20 countries, who are home to most of these multinationals, to bring about regulations that allow countries to report, as I said earlier, to give a country-by-country report by all companies that operate in all countries, and also to enhance automatic information exchange between countries, so that if you suspect that a company operating in your country is actually evading or avoiding taxes, then you are able to trace and find out what it's doing elsewhere.
Bernard, please hold on. We'll come back to you. But we have joining us now Vitus Azim with the Ghana Integrity Initiative. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
We're asking, naturally, some are concerned that this can even fuel money laundering and other corruption. How are you involved in trying to raise these concerns so that government will see it as a challenging issue?
For now, I don't think that in Ghana there are many groups that are involved. But at the international level, we have the Tax Justice Network that is putting pressure on the government, I mean, on the international business community to bring about more transparency, to reduce secrecy in banking laws, so that when you, a Ghanaian, decide that you're going to open a bank account in Switzerland, they should ask you the relevant questions. What is your name? What business are you doing? How are you bringing this money into this country? Not just to take a code number and just take the money. So if, for example, you're a businessman or somebody who has stolen, a corrupt official in the country has stolen money, just go and deposit it. They don't ask about your name or your particular, and they just take it.
Yes.
So at least at our level in Ghana, we are just starting with a branch of the Trust Justice Network, and these are the areas that we're going to look at. But you also recall that we initially, under the NPP government, they were trying to open a tax or offshore banking. Barclays Bank was trying to open an offshore banking system in the country. That has been shelved because of this, the dangers of having this offshore or tax havens in the country.
Yeah, so you are talking about perhaps the G20 coming to your aid, but if it inures to their benefit, do you see them even disclosing those who are putting money in their accounts in those countries?
They benefit, but then their own citizens are putting pressure on them, that they are being unfair to the poor countries, that they boast so much about sending loans and helping us, even when our own people, from some of those loans, are sent back to their countries and put in their banks, and they use it to devolve their countries. So their own citizens are putting pressure on them to understand that it is not helping the poor countries if they allow these tax havens, if they allow these so-called offshore bank jurisdictions to accept these monies without asking any questions, without ensuring that they are paying taxes back in their own countries. Some of it is stolen money, and nothing is done about it. You know that there are pressures on some of these countries to return stolen money by public officials into the countries that they have stolen this money from. In fact, in France, the Transparency International, our local chapter in France, has taken three African countries, African former governments, to court to retrieve money that they have stolen and build palaces and other investments in France, in Paris.
Yes.
So yes, there are some pressures on them to try to realize that what they are doing to the poor countries is not fair.
Do you have specific actions for this country?
Again?
I'm asking whether you have specific actions for this country, Ghana.
Yes, what we are saying is we don't have enough regulatory systems in place. We should not allow ourselves to accept having tax offshore banking system in the country. But again, as I said, we don't have specific actions now for Ghana. We are yet to start the tax justice campaign, and hopefully with time and with the support from outside, we should be able to put a lot more pressure on our governments to do something about it.
Sir Vitus Azim, we want to thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a good evening.
Thanks. Bernard, coming back to you, we've seen that we don't have a lot of options in this country, and we are talking about capacity. So in this case, what do we do?
Yes, what we do, as Vitus said, we have to put pressure on the government to bring out the regulations or policy that will make sure that companies that come to invest in this country disclose their other investment in other tax havens. That, in that way, you'll be able to trace whatever deals that might have gone wrong. For instance, issues concerning management fees. paying to your subsidiary in another country. I mean, it's more or less an intangible thing that you can measure. So it behoves on the company, maybe forging that if the appropriate fee is $100,000 and it tells you it's $150,000, how are you going to be able to determine that? But first of foremost, if you know that the company operates in tax havens and you know all its operations, then you have the information to be able to follow all those leads. So we may not have the capacity, but we could take the steps in making sure that any company that comes to invest in Ghana, we have all the information about where it operates either in Ghana.
Are you going along with the relevant governmental agencies?
Yes. We have been sending briefs to the relevant agencies, and on our campaign too, we hope that we do invite them to our workshops and campaign events.
Do you have a positive feedback from them?
I won't say yes or no, but we know it's a gradual process. Probably they are listening and it doesn't take just a day or two to bring about such changes. It might take a while, but I know they are listening and they may
do something. Bernard Anaba, I want to thank you very much for your time this evening. Bernard Anaba is with ISODEC. Before we go, we have some of your tests here. Gaddafi is gone, but what is the future of Libya? Bright or bleak? Time will tell. Siri Sakara in Wa said so. And Isaac from Alaju. Today is the saddest day in Africa. The NTC of Libya should know that any bomb dropped by NATO, they are going to pay for it. And this one, Moses from Wa. Oh, Gaddafi, go and give chance to others. Baba Musa UDS. If the reported killing of Gaddafi is true, then AU leaders must bow their heads in shame. African Union did not do anything about Gaddafi's case. Why? Isaac Ningpe from Buya. And Gaddafi should have listened earlier to step down to save himself and the family. So sad to hear Alan Burns from Accra. And the West will always eliminate any African leader who advocates African unity. They did same to Nkrumah. God save Africa. Kofi Dambai. Shame to Africa. Oh, Gaddafi, may your soul rest in perfect peace. Nuhu Mbuabula from Boku. And J.B. Kumasi, indeed, Libyans should not forget that those peaceful terrorists, NATO, who helped them to seize power, are godless, sharply educated, and will always patronize them, counting on their ignorance. The oil is going to be used as a solution to the Eurozone crisis. And Gaddafi died as a hero, and Africa has indeed lost an iconic figure. May his soul rest in peace. Raymond Bantabel from Ridge, Accra. And that is where we wrap it all up for today. On behalf of Christopher Esiedu, Bright Agama, Edmund Tete, and Abraham Asari, the production team, together with Owula Kwaji, who sat at the controls for us, and Barbara Yakubu, who did the summaries, my name is Kingsley Obinchere.